All right. I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 3:19 p.m. on Wednesday, April 14th, 2021. Members present are Vice Chair Shragi, Representative McCarty, and Co-Chair Fields, and myself. Co-Chair Sponholz, let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Thanks to our secretary today, Leah Fraser, and our LAO moderator, Alex Banizek, for joining us this afternoon. I want to remind members to speak into your microphones. We can get good audio recording for our House record staff, as well as for our guests that are online. We can see that we've got quite a few already on the teams today, which is fantastic. We've got four items on our agenda today. First, we're going to take up former Representative Dave Tallarico, appointee to the Alaska Worker Compensation Board. Second, we're going to have an informational hearing on Alaska's infrastructure and capital spending. Third, we'll have an informational hearing on the unemployment insurance program and software. And lastly, we will forward appointees that we considered at our last meeting. Welcome to Representatives Kaufman and Nelson, who have just joined us now. Are there any questions from members before we begin? All right, seeing none, that brings us to our first order of business. And do we have Dave Tallarico online? Representative Tallarico?
Madam Co-Chair, I'm here.
All right, great to hear you. Why don't you introduce yourself for the record and tell us about your interest in serving on this board.
Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and the honorable committee members. I appreciate this opportunity. My name is Dave Tallarico. I live and reside in Healy, Alaska. I'm 6 days away from my 52nd anniversary of living in Healy. Love it there. I have worked in the mining industry, been the owner-operator of a business here in Alaska. I've worked as a heavy equipment operator, a powder man, a laborer. I've also worked as a human resource director and a safety director. Have been very heavily involved in those last two occupations with workers' compensation, dealing with both insurance providers and healthcare providers as well. So I am looking forward to this. Madam Co-Chair, I have been appointed to the at-large seat for labor. I'd also like to mention that I'm a retired Teamster and planning on trying to serve as best I could. I think one of the things that's probably most critical for us is equality and being fair to everyone that comes before us, in particularly during any type of case that's heard or an appeal that's heard. And I do appreciate the fact that the legislature over the years has worked very hard, and we have a significant amount of what I consider to be very good statutes to help lead and guide us through our decision-making process. And Madam Co-Chair, as you know, I'm quite a talker, but I will slow this down a little bit and give you folks an opportunity to ask any questions if you have any.
All right. Thanks very much for that introduction. It's good to hear your voice again. Co-Chair Fields.
Thanks, Representative Tallarico. I really just wanted to let you know how much I miss working here in committee with you. Pretty much every time I would learn something in terms of workplace safety or your industry. So I miss you. And thanks for being willing to serve this way. It's hard to imagine, impossible to imagine a more qualified person.
All right. Are there any questions for former Representative Tallarico? All right. Seeing none, it looks like you got off the hook easy, and we're glad you could have one. We'll go ahead and open up public testimony now. Is there anybody online for public testimony? Nope, nobody online. All right, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. I want to just remind committee members at the end, stay afterwards so we can sign the paperwork on this appointee, the appointees from the last session. So next item on our agenda today is an informational hearing on Alaska's infrastructure and capital investment. We have invited a slew of testifiers today for our panel. We have invited Michael Partlow with Ledge Finance, is going to talk about the capital budget. He coordinates the capital budget for us. Nils Andreessen, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. Don Etheridge with the AFL-CIO. Dave O'Donnell, incoming chair of the Associated Builders and Contractors and senior project manager for Watterson Construction. Craig Dahl, Executive Director for the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. Janelle Chaunier, President and CEO of the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. David Gammis, civil engineer and current member of the Alaska Professional Design Council and past president of the Alaska section of the American Society of Civil Engineers. And then Christine O'Connell, executive director for the Alaska Telecom Association. We think that it's timely that we have a conversation about this. The Biden administration and Congress are currently working on a $2.3 trillion infrastructure package, which creates a lot of opportunities for the state of Alaska. We wanted to make sure that we, had a time to learn a little bit about some of the infrastructure needs in the state of Alaska and how we might be able to take advantage of that. So first up, we're going to start with Mr. Partlow, the Capital Budget Coordinator for Legislative Finance.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Partlow. I'm the Capital Budget Coordinator for the Legislative Finance Division, and I'll be trying to give you a very high-level overview of the last 10-year look back for the capital budget. You named a very long list of people right behind me, so I want to make sure I give them plenty of time. Just to jump in at a very high level, I know there are probably members of the public who'll be watching or listening to this. The capital budget is distinct from the operating budget in that capital items are, it's really the state kind of purchasing something on a certain scale, whereas the operating budget is covering personnel and other things for the state. The big distinctions for the capital budget is multiple year appropriation, so sort of minimum amount of time for a capital budget project is 5 years. By definition, a capital budget item is an allocation or appropriation for an asset within an anticipated life exceeding 1 year and cost exceeding $25,000. And examples of it would be new infrastructure, capital improvement, IT upgrades, land purchases and grants out to communities and entities. And the big distinction for the capital budget is sort of, it can be sort of bifurcated in that the majority of the capital budget is funded with federal funding, doing things that the federal government is asking us to do, and we're matching federal funding, and the federal government is giving us a large portion of money. With that comes Fed priorities, Fed desires. In terms of the flexible spending for the state of Alaska to meet our own needs, the number one fund source for that is UGF. So I'll be talking a lot about the UGF capital budget as a measurement over the last 10 years of how the state's been able to spend for its priorities. And examples of GF spending, major maintenance for schools, new school construction, building Alaska class ferries, grant, and a lot of grants to communities for their needs. So moving on to the first slide here, which I'll be doing most of my talking about, is just giving you a historical perspective on the funding level. The bars that you'll see here, the blue bars, are UGF capital budget over the last 20 years. And superimposed on this in red is Alaska North Slope oil price per barrel. For most of the state's history, the number one source of revenue for the state has been oil revenue. The capital budget, by its very nature, is about this, in many ways, about the state's priorities, state projects, and is discretionary in nature. We decide what those priorities are and what those projects are, whereas with the operating budget, it can be much more difficult to change when the amounts of revenue coming in change. Number one cost for the operating budget is funding for schools. That's in statute. It's not something the legislature can very easily change from 1 year to the next, whereas funding for capital projects is something that can very quickly change. And you'll see in terms of this overlay that the legislature itself, when oil prices are low, spends very little on capital, discretionary on capital. And when money comes in, they meet a lot of the capital needs that the state has. New projects, but also a lot of things that have been put off in those prior years. You'll see the peak year of FY13. By FY14, the price of oil had plummeted, and subsequently the state's capital budget went down considerably. So the peak year of FY13, with about $2 billion in UGF spending, all the way down to FY16, where it sort of stabilized at about $130 million in UGF. And you'll see it's stabilized over the last few years, and I'll be getting into this in a moment. That stable amount you'll see there, the vast majority of that UGF is meeting match need for federal programs, and I'll be going into that in a moment. So diving into the numbers a little bit, 06 to FY15, the average was $1 billion for UGF and a total capital budget of $2.3 billion. The peak year that I mentioned, FY13, we spent $2 billion in UGF. And examples that $240 million roughly for the university, named recipient grants like out to communities and entities was $220 million, so meeting a lot of that need across the state that I'm sure the next testifiers will be talking about. Once oil prices went down, we hit an average of about $123 million of UGF, and the capital budget's been pretty stable at about $1.5 billion. In terms of meeting a lot of those state priority needs other than match, we were able for several years to be able to use the reappropriation process to meet that, averaging about $56 million in reappropriations. I mentioned the 5 years lag for projects. As projects wrap up, there's extra money available. The legislature reserves the right to reappropriate that to other needs. But once the high water mark projects are off the books, they're off the books, the money goes away. Going forward, it's a lot harder to find reappropriations, and I'll be mentioning the amounts we're getting now. But the remaining UGF that's in the budget is mostly towards match requirement for $1.16 billion in federal funding. Main areas for federal match, there's three main areas pretty much every year. Federal aid highway match, we put in $71.2 million of match, and we get $680 million of federal funding. That can go towards the state's transportation improvement plan, so working with the feds, picking priorities that the feds agree to pay for versus discretionary paying for Alaska roads and things like that. The state of Alaska is very unique in aviation, that the state manages, I think it's like 225 rural airports. No other state does that. The feds provide some support for that cost, $190 million, and we have to match it with $14.7 million. And the third program is Village Safe Water and Wastewater Match for infrastructure. That's building new wastewater needs for rural Alaska, but it's also maintaining and improving existing infrastructure.
Yes, we've got a question from Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you. Are we maxing out the federal match here, or would adding GF also come with a corresponding additional federal match? Thank you.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Fields, yes, we're maximizing for these programs.
Thank you.
So we've talked about sort of where we've been in the past to give you a snapshot of where we've been in the most recent capital budget. $1.2 billion a capital budget with only $120 million of UGF. Major absences, I would point out, would be deferred maintenance needs. The state has about $2 billion of deferred maintenance. Sort of an industry standard for maintaining your infrastructure is called the 1% rule. You take the value of your property asset, you spend 1% of that value every year to maintain it. State has $9.7 billion in assets. The main holder of sort of property assets is the university. We would need to spend $97 million a year just to keep from growing the deferred maintenance backlog. This was something that was recognized in the past by the legislature. When you saw those high years, the Parnell administration and the legislature worked together to put about $130 million towards deferred maintenance needs every year, and we're able to chip away at that a bit. You can do the basic math there, but as you can see, there's still a considerable backlog. And I mentioned the reappropriations. The good days are gone. Last year, we got $9.4 million in conference committee out of the legislature. The governor vetoed about half of that, maybe a little bit more. So the old money to use for new priorities is going away as well. And I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have. I know that was quick.
That was very useful. Representative McCarty?
I have two questions. One, going back to the previous slide, as the state money, is it we seen any designated funds coming in from any things that I'm thinking of aviation? For instance, that you said that the different airports that we, I'm sorry, can you hear me?
There we go.
Sorry. So through the chair, the question is on the slide dealing with the aviation and state airports and the $14.7 million that the state comes up with. Is there designated monies that's coming in from those airports and usage that helps contribute to the cost of that $14.7
million? Through the chair, Representative McCarty, the money that comes in from the airports, my understanding is that that money is used towards operating needs and basic maintenance. This is a UGF match to match the federal money coming in to do the major capital projects for those.
Follow up.
So do we have any idea of the monies that it's coming into the different airports and seeing how much is coming in that may be contributing to operations of such?
Through the chair, Representative, I can certainly get you that information. Yeah.
Follow up. I'm very interested in that because I know that a couple years ago that there was discussion of adopting an airport, a rural airport. I know an airport that I use that is told that it actually makes a lot more money than what is needed to operate it. And so the question is, like, how much money is coming into these airports? And since it's $14.7 million to bring in $190 million from the feds, is it self-sustaining or giving some sustainability? And that's the question with all these others, what's there? And then one last follow-up,
and then we're going to move on to the next person.
I'll tell you what, I'll just stop at this point. Thank you.
And the capital funds, just to be clear, that we're talking about here are different than the operating funds, and those are in the operating budget, so separate budget there. Representative Kaufman?
Thank you. Through the chair. I've had some discussions here with people about improvement projects on IT where maybe we're going from, you know, locally, what's the right term, hosted applications to applications that are, you know, in the cloud and all the typical way things are done now. And I've learned, I believe in some cases, those are still done as capital projects, even though we're transitioning to what's really more of an expense in normal business accounting, which I know we don't do. So can you just explain a little bit of that? For me, it's interesting to an interesting aspect of how we budget for IT improvements. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, you're absolutely correct. That is an interesting distinction that our office certainly looks at. Paying for a subscription service is usually something that is paid for out of the operating budget for an agency.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about larger amounts of money. It kind of gets into the gray area. As we mentioned earlier in the presentation, you usually get an asset, you know, something tangible. And if it's just a service that's being provided, it does really get into the gray area, and you do kind of get into the legal distinction between a capital and operating area. I wish I could give you a more definitive answer, but it is a distinction, and it is one that we look at, yes.
And I just want to clarify for the public that the state of Alaska does adhere to generally accepted accounting principles, so we do use GAAP principles, just for the public that's watching. Representative Kaufman?
Thank you. Through the chair. So yeah, what I meant to say, I guess, is that things can be different here in concept, such as this situation. And do you see that as something that we need to look at changing to get more aligned with how that's costed out in the private sector? Would that maybe enable us to do improvements if they're not looked at as capital, if we're transitioning to a fee-based service? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman. Yes, I think the distinction here is we're usually talking about a capital project being that transition from having the physical server to having a subscription service. Ideally, after you've expended the money for that initial transition, you're going to be coming into the operating budget, the agency itself will be coming to the operating budget and requesting yearly appropriation for that service. It'll be on the service line of the operating budget going forward, because that's what it is. It's a service. It's just like having your copier fixed or having janitorial service. The distinction for having it be a capital project to begin with is just about, I mentioned the multi-years, so you have money, you want to have a couple of years to do the project. It's a longer transition depending on what's going on. But once you have made that transition from a physical asset to a paid prescription or subscription service, that is better fit for the operating budget, certainly.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Partlow? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And we did have somebody who just called in at 3:30 to testify on the governor's appointee, so I'm going to reopen public testimony so he doesn't have to wait. Mr. McKee, you online?
Yes. My name is Charles McKee. And hello?
Hello. We can hear you just fine.
Okay. My name is Charles McKee. I'm an older due course to my name. My trust has been filed and recorded in 2017, but my experience with the Workers' Compensation Board was prior to that 2015. And during my process, I found out that they held my $113,000, which resulted in me getting evicted and being charged with a reckless endangerment crime. That would have never occurred had it been paid that money that came out of my account. So I found out in the process of appeals to the State Supreme Court of Appeals, I found out that money did, that was extracted out of my Social Security account, because as a Maryland, it simply wasn't transferred to me. So it got
Mr. McKee, extracted, do you have any testimony on the appointee?
Hello?
Do you have any testimony on the appointee, Dave Tallarico?
That's what I'm talking about. When I mentioned this earlier and said that they're in violation of RICO charges, when this guy was chairman of the hearing of the workers' comp previously in January the 14th, when I testified then to the same situation. That what occurred.
All right, you've got 1 minute left, sir.
So what occurred then is still ongoing. What the harm done to me is now part of a court notice of cure with a state court system, because I filed my control of my name, holder in due course, and in 2017. So now I'm going for the $80 million in harm done, and it disappeared within the court system pertaining to Doctors and Nurses Association out-of-court settlement with the current administration, workers' comp, Medicaid, Medicare.
All right, you've got 10 seconds more.
That summarizes it.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony now. There's nobody else online, just for the record. All right. Now we're going to go back over to our infrastructure and capital investment hearing. Next up, we've got Nils Andreessen, with Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League.
Thank you, Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Can hear you just fine.
Great. Thanks for this opportunity to say a few words about infrastructure from a municipal perspective. I want to say that Alaska's local governments own and work to maintain the majority of Alaska's public infrastructure. I can't say that outright because it requires some fact-checking, but it's plausible. Local governments have as many road miles as the Department of Transportation, 87% of Alaska's ports and harbors, 75% of all schools, 47 libraries, 37 power utilities, the majority of Alaska's water and sewer systems, 15 jails, and 109 municipal governments are responsible for maintaining landfills. I think it's important to think about this as a starting point, because for this committee's consideration, I encourage us all to think more about what the more beyond what the state owns or maintains. And together, we should think about these systems of infrastructure that then have overlapping layers of jurisdiction, which we can provide or contribute to. And as part of this, we can think about the goals of infrastructure. For AML, we're thinking about the Constitution, with the state having clear obligations to education, the university, public health and welfare. Public safety probably falls into the latter. Transportation and energy infrastructure probably falls in there as well, but squarely within a goal of economic development. And with economic development as a goal, the provision of infrastructure serves as a way to reduce transactional costs. And essentially what we're trying to do here is lower the cost of doing business in Alaska, even as we contribute to quality of life. These goals are probably consistent across levels of government, and at the local level, infrastructure is what keeps communities whole. Ensuring access and affordability helps to maintain sustainable communities and slows out-migration. A major reason for localities to dedicate approximately or well more than half their budgets to maintaining this infrastructure. I would say that local governments can't do this on their own. Infrastructure development, construction, and maintenance must be done in partnership across federal, state, tribal, and local governments. When I think of need, this becomes even more critical. AML has estimated in recent months that Alaska's infrastructure deficit stands at around $22 billion. That's $2.3 billion for school construction, major maintenance, $1.9 billion for rural water and sewer, at least that much again for urban water and sewer. Just for 40 or so local governments, there's about $4 billion in capital needs. It's roughly $400 million in need for port and harbors, with another $1.6 billion in planned projects. We know the state's deferred maintenance stands at roughly $2.7 billion, and the STIP has roughly $5 billion in projects. That community and regional jails need about $500 million for improvements, and a low estimate for broadband is $2 billion. That leaves things out. It leaves energy infrastructure out. And we appreciate, you know, for instance, the governor's proposal to establish an energy independence fund and to capitalize that with $10 million. But how should we think about that investment when if the need is more like $1 billion? What about housing infrastructure, where by some measures the need to address overcrowding in Alaska's households would require a $7 billion investment? Or childcare, where there are few funding sources available for construction of adequate facilities. And for broadband, as many as 125 communities have speeds of less than 10 megabytes per second, when our state goal is 50. I can say that local governments are doing their part. On water and sewer, we know that between 25 communities, there's a state revolving loan fund debt of more than $200 million that's being repaid. 16 communities are carrying $800 million in school bond debt. Infrastructure expenditures are roughly 50% of a local government's budget, and local governments carry roughly $3 billion in debt related to infrastructure improvements. And we recognize that the state's making its own contributions. It's funded on average about 8% of school construction and major maintenance grants over these last 10 years, with local governments making up the difference or those needs going unmet. The state's contribution to ports and harbors often comes through as harbor matching grants, which have hovered around $10 million or so when they're funded. And most importantly are the matching funds for federally funded projects. And already mentioned has been, well, the state's match for village safe water is critical to this process, and so is the state's match for within the STIP. When the state isn't able to make that investment in infrastructure, and in particular those investments that it has some responsibility for, that shifts that expectation of local governments, which then have to choose between their own competing priorities, education, public safety, quality of life improvements. And this means that a limited tax base is trying to make up for the state's own, and for infrastructure that's benefit may extend well beyond the communities. I'll leave the committee with this. It seems like two things that are missing right now. First, we'd recommend a way for the state to effectively track and evaluate need across the entirety of the infrastructure system. In a lot of ways, we just haven't really been able to get our arms around overall need. Which makes it harder for us all to address and to address together. Second, we would recommend a mechanism within the budget process for allocating funds to meet those needs at a level that is making a difference, and to have that as part of a long-term plan. We encourage adequate state infrastructure investment that corresponds to the state's interest in contributing to economic development and meeting its constitutional obligations. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. You had some great facts in there. If you can go ahead and send that in to the co-chair and we'll distribute it to the full committee, that would be very helpful. Are there any questions for Mr. Andreessen? All right. No questions for you today. Thanks very much for your testimony. Next up, we're going to go to Don Etheridge with the AFL-CIO.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Don Etheridge. I'm with the Alaska AFL-CIO. And our membership, about 50% of them, they really count upon the need for the capital budgets, all of our construction trades folks. It's a big job. The matching grants we're doing with the highway system has been great for the last few years, but we haven't had any vertical construction at all going on. So we got plumbers and electricians and carpenters that are leaving the state because they can't get enough work to keep them going. One of our biggest concerns that we have in capital budgets is the boom and bust. And when we get those big years like we had a few years back, the $2 billion, yeah, that's great. Only problem is everybody from outside comes in, takes those jobs. We're trying to train folks up to take those jobs here locally, our local workers, and we can't train them fast enough to get them onto these jobs. And they wind up bringing outsiders in to take those jobs. And then at the end of it, we wind up with a lot of our folks out of work and happen to go find someplace else to go to work, and they wind up leaving the state. We think that these infrastructure projects are going to be great, but let's spread them out a little bit so that instead of trying to do it all in one big chunk, that we can get it spread out so that folks can go to work and we can keep our home-trained folks right here at home and keep work going for them. That's been one of our biggest concerns about the capital budgets over the years is we train up all these guys and then we lose them. And we can't afford to keep training guys for down south. But we love capital budgets and we're thinking that if we find a happy number, I heard rumors of $200 million, that we could survive on that and it doesn't drag in a whole bunch of outsiders to take that work from us. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Thank you very much for your comments. And Representative Snyder joined us via Teams at 3:58 p.m. Welcome, Rep. Snyder. And I share your concerns about the boom and bust. One of my closest friends, there's a lot of gals that also do construction, is an electrician, and she actually had to look at leaving the state for a while and had to change her career path in order to stay in the state with her spouse. So this is, you know, highly problematic, and we want to make sure that we've got a sustainable budget so we can make sure that we've got jobs year in and year out. Are there any other questions from the committee? All right. With that, thank you very much for your testimony today, Mr. Etheridge. All right. Next up, we're going to go to Dave O'Donnell, incoming chair of Alaska Building and Builders and Contractors.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave O'Donnell. I started in the construction industry right out of high school for an Anchorage area civil contractor before getting hired on with Watterson in 2006, where I'm currently a project manager. A little bit about Watterson Construction. It was started in 1981 and is one of the largest merit shop general contractors in the state. We are close to approaching $1 billion in total revenue and have completed over 220 projects, including military, state, federal, private contracts with individual contracts ranging in cost from $500,000 to $80 million. We employ around 180 Alaskans a year. But I'm here today as the incoming chair of the Alaska Chapter of Associated Builders and Contractors, or ABC for short. It was founded in 1950 with seven contractors gathered in Baltimore, Maryland to create an association based off a shared belief that construction projects should be awarded on merit to the most qualified, responsible low bidder. We now have over 23,000 members, and the Alaska chapter has 121 members across the state. We operate in one of the largest apprentice programs in the state. We champion the ideals of free enterprise, developing training for workforce, and providing contractors with resources required to compete in the ever-changing world of contracting. I want to touch on the importance of capital budgets and how it impacts our ABC members. ABC supports the thoughtful long-term planning for capital budgets that focus on meeting Alaska's infrastructure needs and that offer relatively consistent funding. Enacting large capital budgets during election years and smaller budgets on non-election years makes good political sense, but it doesn't make good project sense. The construction industry is inherently unstable. The search for bidding opportunities and securing the next contract is critical to keeping our companies healthy and our employees working. Adopting a plan for the reliable, sustainable investment into capital budgets will help provide some stability. While having too much work is better than no work, it can create its own challenges. The market will always have somewhat of a boom and bust cycle, but a reliable government capital budget can help smooth out some of those times. The pandemic is an unusual time, and I encourage you to be careful about rapid investments to stimulate the economy. While we want to put people to work and understand the importance of the work to the economy, ABC doesn't believe that the capital budget's purpose should be to try and create job opportunities. Job stimulation should not be the only justification for project approvals. Oftentimes, efforts to stimulate the economy can inject large sums of money into the economy over a short time, creating an inefficient market and resulting in higher construction costs and an influx of out-of-state workers. There's no shortage of good infrastructure projects, from tackling the deferred maintenance list to energy, education, and transportation projects. Our state still has needs, and we understand that. ABC, however, encourages you to adopt a long-term, reliable plan for investing in our capital needs. Thank you for your time and this opportunity to address you all today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for Mr. O'Donnell? All right. No questions for you. Next up, we're going to go to Craig Dahl, Executive Director of the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. We see you. We do not hear you, so you're going to need to turn your microphone on.
How about that?
There we go.
All right. Well, good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. My name is Craig Dahl, and I am the Executive Director for the Greater Juneau Chamber of Commerce, a position that I've held for the past 6 years. But this follows a 42-year career in banking in Southeast Alaska, with the last 18 of those years serving as President and CEO of Alaska Pacific Bank. So I've spent virtually all of my professional years involved with watching the economic factors that have driven the economy of Southeast and specifically Juneau. I'm here today not to speak to a specific project, but to comment on the serious shift in the economic stability and why major capital projects are important to Juneau and the region. As Alaska's capital city, we've always been heavily reliant on state government as the foundation of our local economy, along with federal and local government positions. Diversifying our economy has always been a huge issue for us, and one of those things that's easier talked about, easier said than done. But for perspective on our jobs in Juneau, I just want to comment that since 2003, we've watched over 1,000 jobs leave Juneau, and the majority of those are their government jobs, and most of those are state positions. And this has been a real serious problem for us over the past decade plus. But over that same period of time, mining and a growing cruise industry has provided us that necessary diversity. We actually created almost an equal three-legged stool, if you want to call it that, for our local economy. And, of course, always hoping that the loss of state jobs would stop. But none of us anticipated COVID. No one could have envisioned that a total loss of our cruise industry would happen for all of 2020. That basically took out nearly 30% of our entire local economy, and it was just simply gone. Instead of the anticipated 1.4 million ship visitors, we got 48. And those 48 were off one small cruise vessel. They were trying to make an effort to operate during the summer, but COVID actually struck their first cruise and brought a quick end to that effort. The economic damage to both the city and borough of Juneau and so many small businesses were actually masked to from some one perspective because of the CARES grants, SBA loans, and the use of a lot of personal assets. But the overall loss of employment, sales tax, and the inability for businesses to operate certainly impacted everyone. Now we're staring at the unbelievable loss of a second full cruise season. And we know this impacts other communities in Southeast as well as all of Alaska, and I think the governor's number was a $3 billion hit to the state. But we expect the second season loss to trigger serious impacts on many of our local-owned businesses that serve the visitor industry, along with many others in the retail sectors. So my remarks today are simply meant to encourage you to ensure that there are capital projects that will be directly benefit our community and the region. As a percentage, we're far more reliant on the cruise industry and need every opportunity for job creation through various infrastructure projects. I wanted to add, I think that one of the questions was, what about the Biden administration's pending infrastructure package? And I have to say, first, we hope to see continued funding that will help the impacted small businesses. Certainly the grant for shuttered businesses is going to be one important piece, but at least our industry or our community is going to need a similar amount of infusion for 2021 as we saw in 2020 if we're to get through this. As to projects, the Juneau Chamber has for many years promoted a road into the capital city down Lynn Canal, giving road access to Juneau to all Alaskans. We've also promoted a second crossing to North Douglas Island, which would promote future development, as well as ensure access to emergency services. And we're hopeful to see both of these projects, which are very large, get consideration. Also, the remodel and expansion of our convention center and continued investment in our harbors and roads are all extremely important at this time. Rebuilding our economy at this point is going to be a far greater challenge than we expected, since we simply did not plan on a second cruise season being completely lost. And simply, we need your help with this recovery. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Dahl? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Dahl. You mentioned 30% of the economy coming from the cruise industry. Could you just give the kind of the top three categories? I'm just interested in the breakdown for Juneau.
The top three for just the cruise industry? So we get a tremendous amount of revenue from our mining industry. That's the Hecla Greens Creek Silver Mine and the Coeur Kensington Gold Mine. They're actually our largest property taxpayers, and they each employ close to 400 people. They're actually our largest employer. Half of those people live in Juneau specifically, and about half of them commute back and forth. The other segment of the industry, of course, is our government employees, which is federal, state, and local. And certainly there are other support industries, healthcare and whatnot, but government, tourism, and the mining industry is kind of that three-legged stool is what I'm referring to.
Follow-up?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I was, through the chair, I was just wondering kind of the percentages. So 30% cruise, mining percentage, where would you put that?
I would put the mining and other industries as the other third, along, and then government right alongside of that. And if we were to go back 10 to 15 years ago, our government was probably closer to 65% of our local economy.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for your time today. All right. Next up, we are going to go to Janelle Schwanier with Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. I hope I didn't butcher your name too hard.
You did pretty well, actually. So, yes, I'm Janelle Schwanier from the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. So thank you for the opportunity today. The capital budget is important to the economy of interior Alaska, as I'm sure so many parts of the state, because we in particular need good state infrastructure for commerce to flow effectively in and out of Fairbanks in particular. Our member businesses rely on highways and other state roads to transport goods, move personnel, provide services, and allow customer access. In the interior, we have limited connections to the rest of Alaska and to the lower 48. So we really need those road, rail, and air connections to function efficiently for our businesses to have a chance of succeeding. In 2021, we also need to include broadband internet access in that infrastructure kind of category. With many workers still working remotely from their homes, the shortcomings of our broadband network have become, kind of come into stark focus for us. You don't have to be very remote to have access issues. For example, I work very closely with one of our committee chairs who lives just a few miles from our downtown office, and she does not have the option of signing up for high-speed internet. So we're really feeling that, particularly as an effect on commerce here. Also, construction represents a significant component of the interior economy. I apologize, I don't have a specific number at my fingertips the way our last person did, but the construction industry in Fairbanks is a significant portion of our economy, and they rely particularly on the DOT federal matching funds that are part of the capital budget. The construction season in Fairbanks is severely limited by our extreme weather, so any delay in the receipt of federal funds causes a domino effect, which could result in losing an entire construction season. So that's obviously always a concern when the passage of the capital budget kind of drags on into the summer months. The capital budget provides the state of Alaska, and particularly our region, with an unparalleled opportunity to bolster our economy with the least amount of investment from the strained state coffers. So passing an appropriate and timely capital budget is one of our priorities and is essential for our continued economic health and growth in the interior.
All right. Are there any questions for Ms. Schwenier? All right. There are no questions. Thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it. Next up, we're going to hear from David Gomez, civil engineer and current member of the Alaska Professional Design Council.
Hello, Madam Chair and co-chair and the members of the committee. My name is David Gomez. I'm a civil engineer and project manager at Lounsbury & Associates in Anchorage, a locally owned business since 1949. And I'm here to testify on behalf of the American Society of Civil Engineers, the Alaska section, which is a member organization of the Alaska Professional Design Council. ASCE is a professional organization with 150,000 members worldwide and over 800 members in Alaska. APDC is a nonprofit corporation that represents the common interests of Alaska's design professionals. We represent approximately 5,000 members, including architects, engineers, land surveyors, landscape architects, and interior designers that live and work throughout the state. I'm here to testify to bring awareness to the infrastructure needs in our state. For those who may not be aware, civil engineers are responsible for making it possible to have clean drinking water, functioning roads, airports, dams, railroads, and ports, to name a few. We're also responsible for ensuring that schools and hospitals are safe and structurally sound for our children and family members during catastrophic events like earthquakes. One of ASCE's most critical missions is to advocate for our infrastructure needs, because failing infrastructure impacts not only our economy, but also the safety and livelihoods of all Alaskans. In 2017, the ASCE Alaska section released the first report card on Alaska's infrastructure. This report card was a comprehensive evaluation of 9 infrastructure categories, which included airports, dams, roads, energy, ports, harbors, the marine highway system, water and wastewater, and solid waste. Over 40 volunteers poured through countless publicly available reports and came up with a cumulative grade of C- for our infrastructure. A common theme throughout the report is that our infrastructure is aging and needs repair. Lack of funding for capital improvements and deferred maintenance projects were the number one barrier to improving our infrastructure. Parts of our state are suffering from the effects of thawing permafrost, coastal erosion, and sea level rise, where communities are literally falling into the ocean. We have roads and airports that are not receiving adequate maintenance because it continues to be deferred due to budget cuts. We have areas of our state where families do not have access to clean drinking water in their homes and still use honey buckets. We also have a major port that is situated on piles that are in a state of such corrosion that its structural integrity is compromised. There are many other examples that are included in our report card, and we encourage you all to read it at infrastructurereportcard.org/Alaska. On the topic of labor and commerce, formulating a sustainable budget to tackle these issues is paramount to improving and maintaining quality infrastructure. Our local architecture, engineering, and construction companies depend on this funding to maintain local staff that is uniquely qualified to design, engineer, and construct infrastructure in Arctic and subarctic climates. If we want to fortify Alaska's future, this is a critical element to take into consideration. Educating, employing, and retaining professionals in engineering and architecture is integral for our communities and a stronger Alaska. House Bill 104, which would increase our motor fuel tax to 16 cents per gallon and impose a special registration fee for electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles, is one step in the right direction, which ASCE and APDC fully support, but we recognize and support additional measures needed to generate revenue for the long term. We ask that you take this into consideration in our infrastructure need, as our infrastructure needs repair, and the cost will only compound over time. Alaskans deserve better, so we must build a solid foundation by formulating a sustainable capital budget that will provide the foundation for safe and reliable infrastructure and a highly trained workforce to build and maintain it. Next, if I have time, I have a short video to share that highlights our 2017 infrastructure report card. I'd like to mention that the Biden administration has used part of our national and states report cards as part of the basis for the pending American Jobs Plan. ASCE Alaska section plans to release our updated 2021 infrastructure report card this year and are eager to share it with you. And if I have time, I'd like to share that video. Is there time to do that?
You know what? I don't think we have time to share the video today, but okay. I do encourage folks to read the report. It's very interesting. Are there any questions for Mr. Gomez? Representative McCarty.
Hi, through the chair, the question for you and actually for many others that have presented is, if we look at these capital projects and things that need to be taken care of in our state, and we look at the results of COVID and so many people that are without work and struggling, and in my mind I'm thinking of what happened with President Roosevelt during the Great Depression and the CCC programs. Do you or anybody else believe that something like that could be done in our state to boost back the capital improvements as well as boost back personal purpose type things and employability?
I guess I'll go first and through the chair in responding to that question. As I understand it, in the American Jobs Plan, particularly highlighted in regards to Alaska and opportunities for jobs that may arise from a plan like that, replacing aging drinking water systems and functioning drinking water systems throughout the state has been one of the highlighted items that's included in that package on the national level. There's also a big portion of that plan that is dedicated to high-speed internet access for everyone. So that would create opportunities across the state, particularly in our rural areas that don't have access to high-speed internet. There's also discussion about miles of transmission lines. There are parts of the state that are remote that don't have access to transmission lines and have local diesel generation. That's a major opportunity there. And also the weatherization of buildings and housing throughout the state. Lots of our houses and buildings around the state are aged and could use a weatherization. That's another job opportunity there. And along that, along with that, there's the talk of electric car credits and building out EV charging stations, which the state has very few of. And that is on top of that, there's also the modernization of our highway system. So tackling all of the deferred maintenance and capital projects, you know, it looks as if the plan would have a big influx of funds there for those.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today. And actually, you teed up one of your comments, teed up our next testifier pretty effectively, Christine O'Connor for the Alaska Telecom Association.
Yes, thank you, Chair Sponholz. Yeah, that was a great introduction. For the record, my name is Christine O'Connor. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Telecom Association. Our members are all of the Alaska-based telecom and broadband providers. Just a couple quick factoids. In the last 4 years, ATA's members have invested over $1.2 billion in broadband CapEx. They have upgraded or newly deployed over 50,000 locations. There's tremendous momentum happening in broadband infrastructure right now. But obviously much more needs to be done and much more could be done with additional resources. The Biden American Jobs Act, or the infrastructure package that he has proposed with over $2 trillion in funding, $100 billion of that is dedicated for broadband under the proposal. It would be over an 8-year time period with a very ambitious goal simply to bring affordable, reliable, high-speed broadband to every American. They're also focused on the broadband plan of being future-proof networks, which really means fiber infrastructure. The plan itself is pretty broad. It doesn't have a lot of details. So we're really at the beginning of the conversation about how to implement this. There's been a lot of discussion around the Biden plan as far as what is and isn't infrastructure. I've been very glad to see that during those conversations, everyone agrees broadband is infrastructure. So however the bill becomes negotiated, I'm confident that we will see significant resources for Alaska. You know, they're talking $100 billion, even if you just divided that across 50 states, that would be $2 billion that's under discussion. That is enough money to truly close the gaps and get terrestrial broadband infrastructure, fiber, microwave to every Alaskan. But it's critical that Congress get the details right here. It needs to be distributed with a priority where it's needed most to prioritize truly unserved and underserved areas. Many of those areas are in Alaska. This is a unique opportunity. We are talking with our federal delegation, Senators Murkowski and Sullivan and Congressman Young, are very familiar with the needs for broadband infrastructure in the state and very committed to working for solutions. In fact, we saw in the news and actually spoke with Congressman Young yesterday. He was at the White House on Monday talking with President Biden about broadband infrastructure. We are eager to complete this job. My members could be moving more quickly than they are today with additional resources. So, oh, it's a long way between the introduction of an infrastructure package and actually getting that funding into the ground, but we're optimistic right now and looking forward to the opportunity.
All right. Are there any questions for Ms. O'Connor? Representative McCarty.
So I'm very appreciative, through the chair, very appreciative of you being here. This whole concept of broadband, of technology, and what is coming into the state. I'm wondering that, like I hear a certain company is taking quite a few employees out of the state and services that's going to be serviced in another country. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing that there's service entities that are providing the product or products to Alaska, but their employees are in other states and not in the United States. So as we bring in this technology into Alaska, what gives people jobs in Alaska with the technology rather than it's being farmed out so easily?
Thank you, Representative McKay. Through the chair, I think when we're talking about infrastructure funding like this, that has to be constructed with boots on the ground, and our companies do have those crews and trusted contractors here in Alaska already that are working to build the projects that are underway today. So I'm confident with the funding coming that we would be able to put even more of those crews to work. Now, there are some potential bumps in the road here that with so much funding already being funneled into broadband nationwide, there's actually a shortage of the fiber cable that you would want to install. Some of our companies are having to place orders 7 months or more in advance. The same thing I could envision happening for skilled crews. You know, a lot of my member companies have worked with the IBEW members. There, if too much, I don't even want to call it too much, but if a lot of funding is flooding in at once, it could just meter out the time it takes to complete these projects.
Yes, follow up. So with this, if capital projects and supplies for the projects like the cables, is that something that you envision that could be produced here in Alaska? Or are we dependent upon outside sources for these capital projects to be completed?
Through the chair, I'm not aware of fiber cable being manufactured in Alaska at all. And I haven't explored that idea, but if there are significant resources, it would definitely be something to look at. But my sense is this is something that's produced on a massive scale for worldwide markets. So it may be something that would be difficult to pull into Alaska. Just something I haven't looked at before, so I don't have a better answer.
Just to follow up, it's like we're a state of huge resources. And if the basic resources are the elements are here in the state, you know, is it feasible that we could be creating these products in the state that affects the state and also it produces an industry that serves the world?
Co-Chair Fields.
Thanks, Co-Chair Sponholz. Just a comment that, you know, during the pandemic, we saw a lot of large employers in the Pacific Northwest region go to remote workforce. Some of those, the arrangements are permanent. REI canceled or actually sold its headquarters in Seattle. So when I think of broadband, I think of the ability to actually recruit and retain workers who might otherwise live in Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, who can live in Anchorage, do their work from Anchorage, and pay taxes, patronize local businesses. But that's only possible with functioning broadband infrastructure. So I think in the context of live, work, play, which our business community has pushed for a long time, broadband is actually essential. And that is the long-term path that Anchorage has to economic prosperity, which is attracting and retaining highly productive people. Whereas the old paradigm was, you know, investing in an individual facility or a particular sector. We have a different paradigm now, and the foundation is broadband. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'll just add that there are startups that are interested in doing just that very thing in the state of Alaska. What we have in Alaska is an amazing quality of life. And if you love the outdoors and you love to play in the mountains and you love to fish and do those things, having adequate access to broadband and high-speed internet means that you could theoretically work here, or you could live here, work for a company somewhere else. But we also know that in the state of Alaska that, you know, we have equity issues as it relates to access to these things. And if we were to dramatically expand access to broadband and high-speed internet, and we're gonna have much more conversations about this in the committee here in the coming weeks, that would improve access to education, to healthcare, and also help us to further sort of diversify our commerce communities all across the state of Alaska. If you could imagine starting, you know, having your own startup business in Aniak and being able to have your children be educated and get access to, you know, high quality health care without having to leave your home community, that's a really wonderful sort of step forward in terms of self-determination for rural Alaskans, but also being able to live with one foot in both worlds in a way that I think represents the future of Alaska in a lot of respects. Are there any other questions for Ms. O'Connor? All right, with that, thank you very much for your testimony today. That concludes our invited testimony today on infrastructure. I think that, we heard a lot of really interesting comments today on this topic. There was some comments about wanting to make sure that we had stable infrastructure. Some of the good news is, as it relates to the Biden administration's job plan, is that those will be, you know, we'll have 8 years to spend a lot of that money, which is actually pretty sustainable and could produce a lot of opportunity for the state. We didn't talk about other areas of that package, which include also funding for housing, funding for renewable energy. We have incredibly high energy costs in the state of Alaska. One of our members is the chair of the energy committee, and I know that they're thinking about that issue as well. There's a lot of opportunities for the state of Alaska if we're poised to take advantage of this and make sure that Alaska gets its fair share of that really important resource. All right. And with that, we're going to move on to our next topic, which is an informational hearing on unemployment and our unemployment insurance software. And we have Director Patsy Westcott with Unemployment Training and Services, who this committee has heard from before. And we also have available with her for questions Clifford Napier, who's the Assistant Director at the Division of Employment and Training Services, and James Danner, the Technical Manager for the Division of Employment and Training Services. And as everybody knows, these are the folks that do, we just turned the lights on in the room, it got a lot brighter. These are the folks that processed unemployment claims and managed that process. This last year, we saw record high unemployment, and they took on some pretty extraordinary efforts and ran into some structural challenges in doing that work. So we're going to have a hearing on that and have an opportunity to ask some questions and learn a little bit more about an opportunity to potentially improve the system moving forward. Ms. Westcott, are you online?
So good afternoon. Can you guys hear me okay?
We can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. Thank you so much. So thank you, Representative Svanholz and Co-Chair Fields. For the record, my name is Patsy Westcott. I'm the Director of the Division of Employment and Training Services with the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Also on the line is Cliff Napier. He is an Assistant Director with the Division with specific oversight over the administration of the Unemployment Insurance Program, and James Danner, who oversees the Unemployment Insurance Data Processing Liaison Unit. So I'm going to give just a brief overview or explanation of our current unemployment insurance system, and then Cliff and James and I will be available to answer any questions that you might have. So our current system is a legacy mainframe system that went to production in early 1994, so it's almost 30 years old. The current system administers all aspects of unemployment insurance, so from our benefit claims intake and processing, our taxes, the collection of our taxes, our wage data, processing claims, and eligibility determinations. What I would say about our current system is that under normal circumstances, our system has worked very well for us, and it is robust. But with that said, the current circumstances are not typical for the unemployment insurance program. And so our current system is not easily configurable to accommodate anything other than regular unemployment insurance. And so with our current environment, and as was the case during the Great Recession in 2008-2009, we have multiple federal programs right now that our system has created, it's created complexities as far as trying to implement those. Only one program can be implemented at a time, except for PUA. Every CARES Act program had to be built from the ground up. And so aside from the pandemic unemployment assistance program, which was something that we contracted out, in our regular unemployment insurance program, every other CARES Act program had to be built from the ground up. This created some complexities as far as programming, because our system, again, was designed to just pay regular unemployment insurance program. And so once you start trying to layer programs one on top of the other, then we get into a situation where the programming and the testing for that is complex and time consuming, and then what I would say is that through the course of the pandemic, the program requirements changed. And so the initial guidance that we received from our governing body, which is the USDOL, changed over time. And so that also created another level of complexity that required us to make changes to the program. And the base system was not designed to start layering these programs where you have different start dates and end dates for each program. And so with that said, we've had some challenges for sure. We were getting ready to embark on a new system. We update, and then COVID hit, and we had to sideline that project. And so we are, now that things are starting to settle down, we are getting ready to reinvest our resources to go back to implementing a new system that will be absolutely more robust, that will be able to respond to these changes, in whether it's a state change or a federal change, that this new system will be able to respond more efficiently than we were able to do during COVID.
Ms. Westcott, are you there?
I'm sorry. Can you not hear me?
I think we can hear you now. I was just thought we, there was a long pause, and I thought maybe we'd lost you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So what I would say is that we have had significant challenges in responding to all of the different programs that we were hit with. It was a tsunami. as a result of COVID, and while our our mainframe system under normal circumstances is or was prepared to pay regular benefits. Under the tsunami that we were hit with as a result of COVID, we had challenges for sure, and I'm not going to sugarcoat that. Our system, as I said, is almost 30 years old, and it just wasn't built to respond to that layering of multiple federal programs that have different start dates and different end dates and different eligibility requirements. And so certainly we had challenges responding and being able to get those programs up and running in very short order. Prior to COVID, we had started to lay the groundwork to move from our current mainframe system to a different system. And then once COVID hit, we had to divert our resources and we couldn't move forward with implementing a new UI system. So we had to divert all those resources implementing the various programs that were provided for under the CARES Act. And so we had to sideline that project. What I will say is that we have positioned ourselves to get back on track with upgrading our UI system. We're very excited about the system that we've chosen. We've watched the states that have the one system that we've identified that would be really a good fit for Alaska. We've watched the couple of states that had this system prior to COVID, and we've watched their ability to be able to implement the various provisions of the CARES Act program and the extensions that have followed, and we are excited about how quickly they were able to do so. And so we are prepared to move forward with that now that things are starting to settle down a little bit. We're just really looking forward to moving forward with this new system that we've identified that would be a good fit for Alaska.
All right, thank you. Representative McCarty has a question.
All right, thank you, through the chair. So, Ms. Westcott, what is the name of the new system?
So, through the chair, Representative McCarty, the vendor that we have identified is called Medicine. We are looking at entering into a consortium with some other small states. And I can explain what that means if you would like me to do so.
Please do.
Okay. So through the chair, Representative McCarty. So one of the things that, let's see. So how do I best explain this? So there are a number of ways that a state can implement a new UI system. And one of those is through entering into a consortium with other states. And what that enables a state to do is really leverage our resources. And when states can come together in a consortium type of effort, we're able to leverage our resources so that actually implementing a new system is more cost effective. If a state goes off on its own to implement a new UI system, especially for both tax and benefits, the cost to the state can be upwards of $60 million. And $60 million is actually a conservative estimate. if a state can enter into an agreement with other states to work together with other states and utilize a vendor and a system that will work in multiple states, the cost can be significantly less. And so one of the things that Alaska has been looking at over the years is exactly that, is entering into a consortium effort. One of the things that you have to look at when you enter into a consortium type situation is making sure that the consortium is going to, for lack of a better explanation, but it's making sure that the consortium is going to really advocate for the state. And so you want to be careful when you enter into a consortium that you don't get into a situation where, like, we're a small state, and not geographically, but as far as our UI workload and the amount of benefits that we pay out, we're considered a small state. And so if you enter into a consortium with a really large state, you can lose your voice, so to speak. And a large state such as California or Washington can overrun you. And so the needs of what you might have for your program and for your system to be able to deliver services to your constituents and your clients can be overrun by a large state. And so one of the things that we have really tried to pay attention to is making sure that we find an opportunity that would allow us, number one, to enter into a consortium so that it's cost effective for us as a program, but number two, so that it's also so that it's also effective for us as a state so that we still have a voice. And so we have identified a consortium with several other small states with a really great UI system solution that meets our needs and that will enable the state of Alaska to move forward with a more robust system so that we can respond to these types of situations that we've just had to deal with in this last year, but that at the same time will be more fiscally responsible for the state as we move forward.
Ms. Westcott, can you give us sort of a contrast? So you said that purchasing our own system would be at a minimum $60 million. What's the price for entering into a small state consortium like the one you've identified?
Yeah, Chair Sunholz, that's a great question, and thank you for asking that. And so the opportunity that we are looking at, so the vendor that we're looking at and the consortium that we're looking at entering into, there is no upfront cost to the state other than the cost to the state for our own state resources of working through the project and implementing the project. And so we are looking at approximately a $6 million layout as far as state resources to work with the vendor to implement this solution in Alaska. And then and that's our cost, state resources, maybe a project manager to oversee the project. But this particular vendor that we're looking at does not have an upfront cost. Their business model is such that once the programming is done and the solution is up and running, their business model is that they charge us a very small percentage of our annual base grant for continued support for the product.
So sort of, that's sort of dovetailing on our conversation that we had earlier with Michael Partlow, our capital budget manager, that a lot of IT solutions are going to more of a cloud-based model and that you essentially lease access to the software. And what's the annual, so it's a, it would be a percentage of our grant. So roughly, if we were talking about the FY22 budget, what would that be roughly?
Yeah, so, and it, so first of all, Representative Sponholt, this is a cloud-based model, and roughly it would be 3% of our annual base grant in, let's see if I can shortly figure that out.
You could also get back to us with that number. I mean, I think that that number will be useful for us, but I think that you could get back to us with that number. I think one of the questions that I have is this last year, you know, one of the things that we found because we were using this, and I'm going to call it antiquated system. My husband is in IT, and you know, mainframe systems are not the standard anymore for sure, and he literally does database management, so they're not the norm. Can you describe how long it took to implement programmatically every single change that came to the came through the unemployment insurance program, and how many changes there were that you needed to implement during this time frame, roughly?
Oh dear. So, Chair Sponholt, what I would say is that for every, so the CARES Act created multiple new benefit programs that were outside of the traditional unemployment insurance program. What I would say is at a minimum, it took us 8 weeks to implement each one of, at a minimum of 8 weeks to implement each one of those. There were a few that took us longer than the 8 weeks, for sure. Interestingly enough, we, so the system that we're looking at and that we're very interested in entering into a consortium with other states, we looked at, we've been monitoring what has happened in the two states that have implemented this other system. And their response time was 2 weeks. So the response time is significant. Again, the system that we are looking at is much, much more able to respond to these type of episodic programs, and in a much easier time frame, much less cost to the state. And again, because it's a consortium, it's just much more cost effective to the state.
Yeah.
To answer your earlier question, you had asked me about
said annual cost?
You had asked me about the annual cost, and the annual cost is about $700,000.
All right, thank you. $700,000 a year. That's a lot better than $60 million to buy your own system. That seems a lot more sustainable. Representative McCarty has a question, and then I've got a couple more.
Yeah, through the chair, a couple questions with this. One is, are we committed to the legacy program for a period of time where we have money tied up in this because of a commitment? And the second question with that is, you said that you're already putting together or looking to develop a new program before COVID hit. And is that the same one that we're looking at now, or is that a different program, and are we financially committed to that as well?
So, through the chair, Representative McCarty, to answer your question, prior to the pandemic, we had started to lay the groundwork to get off of the legacy mainframe system. We haven't committed to any costs in doing so at this point. And as far as the legacy mainframe program, we're not committed to any continuing costs if we choose to move on and build a new UI system. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does, the first question. So the second question, are we committed to cost to some new program that you were developing before COVID hit? Or is that the same one that we're talking about currently in this consortium?
So through the chair, Representative McCarty, we have not yet committed to any new costs as far as getting off of the legacy program that we are on. We just started to lay the groundwork so that we could implement a new UI system, but we have not yet committed to any cost.
So there's no commitment, just to clarify, there's right. No commitment that's been made, but the system that they're proposing is the same one that they had been working on exploring prior to COVID.
Yes, thanks for that. I deal with in healthcare electronic medical records, and I could get in the cloud system. And if I don't like that system, I may be committed to something, and you're saying we're not committed to, but I could move client information, patient information very rapidly. And are you stating that if we were to get this new system, we could rapidly move all the information necessary, and it will propagate into the correct components with little effort? Is that what I'm hearing?
Chair Sponholz, if I could punt to our DPL manager, Jim Danner, to respond to that question, because I'm not sure I understand the nature of the question.
I think he was asking about the amount of time it would take to migrate to the new system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So through the chair, I would like for James Danner, our DPL manager, to speak to that.
Mr. Danner?
For the record, my name is James Danner. I am the data processing liaison unit manager for the department. Through the chair, to the representative. the migration would approximately take a year and a half to go from the current system to a new system. And that's going to be about the same regardless of any system we went to. This just has to do with the time it takes to configure the new system so that it meets our requirements, and also the migration of data, which conversion of data is always, a bit of a tricky subject and takes quite a while to get through correctly.
Yep. Okay, thank you.
That sounds pretty typical for a big data migration project, like the kind of thing that that we're talking about. I've participated in a couple of these big projects for organizations that I've worked for over the year, and depending on the complexity of this of their your migration, it can take more than that sometimes as well. So one of the questions that I just, you know, to sort of illustrate the challenges this last year that took place, I think, you know, there were some elements of in addition to the CARES Act programs that you were required to implement and really probably wanted to implement in order to make sure that Alaskans were financially taken care of in times of crisis. The legislature also passed HB 308, which had several program changes. Do you remember, Director Westcott, the time frame by which all of those changes passed in HB 308, which were passed, it was passed at the end of March, in that last week of March? What was the time frame in which all of those changes were finally able to be implemented?
Yeah, so Representative Sponholz, what I would say is that the waiting week provision, I think, was a little easier for us to implement. Certainly, the change to the dependents allowance was an extremely complex and much more difficult provision for us to implement, and Jim Danner, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but can you comment on as to how long it took us to implement that? Because I know it was considerable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, through the chair, we were able to implement that fully by mid June. 2020, so that took us 2.5 months, if not a little bit longer, to implement. That one was very challenging. It was something that seemed very simple on its face, but when the rubber met the road and we had to put it in the system, it wasn't.
Yeah. All right.
And so if I could just add to that, So our system was not designed to make changes to someone's monetary entitlement in the middle of their monetary entitlement and then only for a specific period of time for their monetary entitlement, which is essentially what that dependence allowance change did. And so it was incredibly complex and very difficult for our IT staff and for James's staff to first program and then test. And so it did take us a considerable amount of time, regrettably so. And one of the reasons that we are really excited about this solution that we had been looking at prior to COVID and that we're continuing to look at, and we're really excited about getting back to, you know, kicking off that program and replacing the system that we have, is that it is much more agreeable to making these types of changes where it's not just a system that is ready to just pay regular UI, but that you can layer it and build onto it and make changes to it as situations occur and as changes from Congress occur and new programs are implemented at a congressional level, this new system will allow us to be able to respond more efficiently and more timely to these types of changes that we've experienced in this last year.
All right. Is it possible that would the new system also be able to help us reduce errors? We know, one of the things that we'd heard was that there had been quite a few errors with, you know, with benefits that were awarded, and a lot of folks, maybe not a, you know, a huge number, but it was a pretty big hardship on them, received benefits and then received letters sometimes months later asking them to repay thousands and thousands of dollars that they'd already spent?
Yeah, so Chair Sponholz, thanks for that question. And you know, I don't know that we've really looked at this new system specifically in relation to that. What I will say is regarding the overpayments that have occurred as a result of the multiple federal programs, what we're seeing or what we've experienced is, you know, we received additional guidance from USDOL, and specifically related to the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, that the guidance that was issued to states was make these payments to an individual based on their self-attestation regarding their work and earnings. And so states did that. And then the clients had 21 days to provide wage documentation before states could go in and reduce the weekly benefit amount. And if clients didn't present that information within 21 days, then states were required to go in and reduce the weekly benefit amount, which resulted in a lot of overpayments. In addition to that, there were because the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program ended up presenting a nationwide opportunity for what I would say was pretty significant fraudulent activity, not necessarily in the state of Alaska, because we've done very, very well, but nationwide, that program presented an opportunity for significant fraudulent activity. USDOL walked back on the guidance that they had initially issued to states, and states received new guidance about the documentation and the requirements that we were expected to adhere to and retroactively adhere to. And so as a result, the PUA program has been an extremely challenging program, and quite frankly has resulted in a number of situations where significant benefits have gone out the door, and then as a result of changing guidance from USDOL, we've had to deny benefits. And so what I would say is that what we are doing in the state of Alaska is we have set up a team that Cliff and his folks have set up a team that is dedicated to reviewing every single pandemic unemployment assistance denial for accuracy. We are going through that documentation. We are looking at their eligibility. We are reaching out to those individuals. And we are liberally applying the guidance that was given to states with regard to the waiving of overpayments. And so as our team is working through every single one of these overpayments, if we look at that overpayment and we think that it was through no fault of the individual and we think that collection of the overpayment is against good conscience and equity, we are reaching out to those individuals one by one so that we can work them through the waiver of the overpayment that we have. And we are taking a very we're using the guidance that we've been given from USDOL regarding the flexibility of waiving those overpayments, and we are taking an extremely liberal and flexible stand regarding the waiving of those overpayments. So we are reaching out to those individuals one by one.
All right, thank you. I think that's pretty important. I mean, there were people who used those payments to pay their rent and utilities and buy groceries for their children, and then got letters asking for, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars to be repaid after they'd spent that. You know, to make a personal point, my mother was one of these people. This is, you know, who, you know, was a rule follower and, you know, did everything she thought she was supposed to do and, you know, used her benefit to pay for her rent and then received a letter saying that she needed to pay thousands of dollars, you know, in back payment. And there were several other, you know, well-documented and reported cases in the news about that. And I think that, you know, if problems, mistakes are made along the way, I think it's important that, you know, we find a way to try to avoid making those mistakes in the future, and also to try to avoid holding people that are already in financial crisis from creating an additional crisis moving on. At the same time, we also understand the importance of preventing fraud and making sure that we're not taking advantage of resources. But I think we saw several cases that were reported in the news of people that had done everything from their perspective right and then found themselves in a financial crisis as a result of change in understanding of their situation. And I don't think we needed to add insult to injury in a time of fiscal crisis. All right. Are there any questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Director Westcott. Go ahead.
Well, what I was just going to say is, Representative Swanholz, I agree with you. You know, the direction that came out to states early on versus the direction that came out to states at a later point in time created this situation where we have clients that applied for and received benefits in good faith, thinking they were doing the right thing. And so that is one of the things that the division is doing, is going through every single one of those overpayments to evaluate where we can extend those waiver positions or those waiver provisions so that individuals who applied for and received benefits in good faith are not penalized.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions for Director Westcott? You've been very generous with your time today. So this brings our thank you very much for your presentation. Thanks also to Clinton Napier and James Danner for joining us today. This brings us to our last item of business, and that is forwarding the governor's appointees that we considered at our last meeting. The House Labor and Commerce Committee has reviewed the qualification of the governor's appointees and recommends that the following names be forwarded to a joint session for consideration: Justin Ruffridge, Board of Pharmacy; Rachel Berngart, Board of Veterinary Examiners; May Hayes, Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. This does not reflect the intent of any of the members to vote for or against any of these individuals during further sessions for the purposes of confirmation. This wraps up our business this afternoon. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. The next meeting will be Friday, April 16th at 8 a.m. in Gruenberg 120. That's the room next door. We're going to have second hearings for SB 87, the governor's bill on reinsurance, HB 145, Rep. Snyder's bill relating to pharmacists, HB 149, co-chair Fields bill relating to collective bargaining for child care providers, and an introductory hearing for Representative Nelson's HB 125 relating to employment preferences for active military members, veterans, their spouses, and dependents. Thanks very much again to our secretary, Leah Fraser, and our LIO moderator, Alex Banasek. And with that, this meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 5:09 p.m.